Hello everyone and welcome to another OneLiner.com podcast. I am Craig Eastman and as always with me are Scott Morris.
A very good evening to you.
And Drew Tavendale.
Likewise.
We are here to pour critical custard upon the steaming toffee pudding of your cinematic consumption, such delights as The Dark Knight Rises. But without further ado, let us get on with a couple of smaller reviews. Hey Scott, word has it that Steven Soderbergh has directed a film about male strippers and that.
Yes. There's been a lot of buzz about Magic Mike, but there's a lot of buzz about wasp nests too, and it's not a good idea to stick your face in them either. I'm not sure where I'm going with this.
No,
if that's
we
about
like
male
it.
Strippers, I'm kind of concerned.
Soderbergh's latest is Magic Mike. Channing Tatum plays the titular Magic Mike, a 30-year-old with many fingers and many pies, delicious business pies such as roofing companies and car body workshops, and his personal favourite, custom furniture design. However, these attempts at diversification have produced only small, slightly sustainable pies. The biggest, beefiest pie is in the form of Mike's career as a stripper. I'm not sure where I'm going with these pie references.
I don't know, but if in a minute there is a pie filled with big meaty sausages, I'll be physically sick.
Pardon. Mike, however, seems happy enough with his life, but unbeknownst to him, the act of employing young drifter Adam, played by Alex Pettifer, initially as a roofer and then later as a stripper in the club owned by Dirty Cowboy Dallas, played by Matthew McConaughey, will change his life.
He's a dirty cowboy.
He's a dirty cowboy.
Bad cowboy, dirty cowboy, and his bed in his basket.
So life-changingness is going to be catalysed partly by Adam's reckless nature, but also more with his relationship with Adam's initially completely uninterested sister, Joanna, played by Oliver Munn. Plot-wise, there's not really much to Magic Mike, which is kind of why I've started waffling about pies and wasps. It's a character piece. Mike realises over the course of the film that his priorities need realigning and he can't keep up the stripper game forever, and it's a fairly low-key struggle to kind of realign him. There's no forced attempts at shoehorning crisis and drama into areas where it shouldn't be, and it's probably a stronger film for it, although kind of harder to talk about in any kind of interesting way. The obvious selling point to the film, as you probably can't escape from the trailers, revolves around gyrating, oiled-up beefcakes parading around in thongs. While that will appeal to the Hen Night crowd, it's probably selling itself a little bit short. Tatum is given a rare opportunity to show off some actual charisma and proves that he's actually quite likeable with a charming personality that's kind of missing from the selection of filmatic duffers that he's been saddled with lately. His relationship with Joanna is believable and the two share pretty good chemistry. The supporting cast do their job well and it features even that rarest of rarities, a likeable Matthew McConaughey. The plot's hardly trailblazing, but it's solidly handled and the backdrop of Tampa makes for a strong and glossy visual appeal, which Soderbergh is occasionally known for, and he keeps everything going along with a reasonable clip. This film's been something of a surprise hit, and it's probably going to be one of the most profitable films of the year due to its strong showing and fairly modest production costs. It's by no means the best film of the year, for sure, but it's a solid, likeable entry in the year's film schedules. History will, I'm sure, record this as not much more than a minor work on all concerns' careers, apart possibly from The Accountants, but it's also going to go into the good column of their film karma. Worth making extraordinary efforts to see? No, it's not extraordinary enough to warrant that. It is, however, better than ordinary. One of those kind of solid 3.5-star films, if you're going to give it some kind of star rating. If you do wind up watching it, you probably won't be disappointed by it, but yeah, it's not worth breaking down the doors to get in front of. Better than I expected.
And fortunately, from what you're saying, Scott, not what you feared it might be, and be a companion piece to Steven Soderbergh's financial advisor Hooker's film.
No, I did actually watch The Girlfriend Experience, which you were talking about earlier. That was on. It showed up on the streaming of Love Film. I say watch, it was kind of on, but it's very difficult film to pay any attention to because nothing happens in it at all. It's very badly acted by.
May I just say, I told you so.
Yes, yeah.
Did either of you see Haywire yet?
No.
No.
I was quite disappointed given that that garnered some word of mouth, so I wasn't sure because I'm pretty sure he filmed that kind of back-to-back with Magic Mike and possibly another film as well. I don't know, I can't qualify that with any kind of paperwork. So yeah, I was interested to see how this one turned out. So it sounds like it's not exactly set in the world of Light Scott, but you wouldn't go out of your way to avoid it.
No, that sums it up quite accurately.
Magic. That mic. Drew, Keira Knightley and Steve Carell is the teaming up of cinematic titans that we've all been waiting for, and don't you know, I'm told that it's happened in the form of Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
Yeah, I mean, Steve Carell and Keira Knightley, obviously the modern day Bogey and Bacall that everybody's been waiting for. An apparent Armageddon style rescue mission having failed to stop it. A huge asteroid is going to crash into the Earth and kill everyone. And it's going to happen in less than a month. And that cheery setup is the setting for the start of this film. Earth's imminent destruction finally gives Dodge's wife, Linda, the impetus to leave him, and she runs off into the night, leaving Dodge alone at the end of the world. After meeting for the first time his neighbour of 3 years, young Britt Penny, played by Keira Knightley, the two embark on a journey to get Penny back over the Atlantic to her family in Surrey, and to reunite Carroll's Dodge with his high school sweetheart before rocky oblivion. Now, not to the extent of some of the more egregious examples we've complained about recently, but once again, I feel I've been sold a dummy by the trailer, which, while doesn't promise a laugh riot, it does seem to suggest that seeking a friend for the end of the world is more of a black comedy than it actually is. And while there are plenty of funny moments, the heart of the film and the dominant thread of the second half is a romance. And romance films typically not really my cup of tea. Fortunately though, this film is actually rather touching and not the maudlin saccharine nightmare it could have been. Steve Carell plays well the familiar, but not yet tiresome, lovable loser role we've seen him in on numerous occasions. And Knightley is a bohemian vinyl lover who, while getting dangerously close to being impossibly quirky and spouting shite about the superiority of vinyl, remains likable and...
One of those, eh?
Oh, yes.
Not that I count you as the dismissive amongst my friends. Oh dear, vinyl, shite.
Despite these drawbacks, she remains likable and funny throughout, even if I think it'd be reasonably fair to say that she's at the limits of her ability in a few scenes. But there's an engaging warmth between the characters as the relationship develops, making the outcome believable. And I'm not spoiling anything here. While you may not know how they get there, you're kidding yourself if you don't know where a romantic comedy, well-ish, set at the end of the world is going, because they all go to the same place.
Croydon.
McDonald's.
Croydon.
McDonald's in Croydon.
McDonald's in Croydon, yeah. By way of an eastern seaboard, northeastern United States, which looks in no way at all like Southern California. Nope. Not even a little bit. Had me completely filled. That's an aside, it just did bring back memories of that scene in Austin Powers 2 when he said, isn't it funny how England looks no way like Southern California? It's an eminently watchable film, even if, like me, romantic films aren't your thing. But I would have been happier if there had been more of the gallows humour from the first half of the film throughout the whole piece. Still, can recommend it's worth watching. The characters are likeable, there's funny bits, there's touching bits without being over the top. It's solidly entertaining, quite a nice little piece of film. Nothing spectacular, not going to remember it with any great fondness, but it's certainly worth watching it for some evening.
Well, if I had to give my thoughts on it, they would be this. Ah, sorry. Of course, I haven't seen the film. That was just me blowing my nose. Scott?
Thanks for your input.
no problem, buddy.
I concur. Again, featuring one of these rarest of rare things, a likeable Keira Knightley performance.
What?
It's definitely the end of the fucking world. They've got quite a good chemistry. Steve Carell does his hangdog thing again, which works really well both every time he's done it. The chemistry's pretty good. It's very likable. I actually cared about the characters. Yeah, enjoyed it, but I would give it a recommendation. It's pretty good. Obviously, you know exactly where it's going to go. There's no real surprises here, but it's not really the film that was going to ever going to deliver those. Some of the gags in the first half are pretty good. Works very well, but far better than it probably has any right to. Give it a bash. I liked it.
Holy smoke. So, which filler aside, we can now get on with the real business of tonight's podcast, I suppose, which would be The Dark Knight Rises, the third and final in Stephen Nolan's trilogy of Batman movies.
Who's Stephen Nolan?
Stephen Nolan.
Is he the silent partner?
Yeah. Obscure art house classic.
Stephen Nolan. Sorry, let me cue that one up again. Which filler aside, we can now move on to the real meat and potatoes of tonight's podcast, I suppose, which is The Dark Knight Rises, the third and final part in Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy, and which I suppose probably needs little introduction, but would you, one of you guys want to give it one anyway?
If you've not seen the first two films, you probably don't want to see this, there's no point. And if you've seen the first two films, you know all you need to know and you're going to watch it.
Well, yeah, I was going to say box office figures so far would suggest that if you did want to see this film, you already have. So I guess then, guys...
I suppose it's maybe worth saying the setup of it, given that we're we are, or at least I am, going to talk about a character arc. And if you want to talk about the arc, you probably need to know where it's going. So it's set 8 years on from the events of the Dark Knight. The Harvey Dent's good names have been reserved and used as an inspiration for sweeping new laws and police powers that's eradicated all organised crime from the city. No longer needed, Batman's hung up his cowl and is a banged up, limping, disheartened Bruce Wayne withdraws to the rebuilt Wayne Manor, seemingly just waiting for death or Gotham's hour of need, whichever comes first. The plot starts moving along after taking a while to wallow in misery. Wayne's interest is piqued by Catwoman, Selina Kyle, played by Anne Hathaway, taking an interest in Bruce's family jewels. Not that sense. A pearl necklace. Not in that sense. Christ, just move on.
Do you see what he did there?
Your main bad fella, and this is Bane, played by Tom Hardy, although you'd never recognise him, but with the weird mask and the, I think it was about 350 pounds of muscle that he's put on to play Bane. He certainly bulked up a bit anyway.
He's been eating steaks, isn't he?
Bane's a mysterious, feared mercenary that, it turns out, is now in control of the League of Shadows after Ra's al Ghul's plan from Batman Begins was derailed.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Oh, you're on. You listen to man. You may be ill, but you're on form tonight, man. You're on fire.
I'm on fire. It's really sore. The League of Shadows are out for revenge. Apparently, the first confrontation with the resuited Batman and Bane ending with Bane breaking Batman's back, which is, try saying that 10 times quickly. So Batman is thrown in a hellhole of prison. Bane comes up with a pointlessly convoluted screen to take control of Gotham, and it's left to Batman to kind of rebuild his body and his mind and then re-challenge the League of Shadows and ensure a happy ending for Gotham and his character. So that's your basic setup from it, and someone else can start talking about how good or otherwise it is from here on.
True. Good or otherwise.
Very good, I would say. Yeah. Oh, you want more?
Moving on, yeah.
Yeah, moving on. Let me start by saying that I was mildly disappointed, but...
Yes, I noticed that you'd said that.
Yes, what
surprised me.
Qualify yourself, obviously, what worked for you for the film.
Oh, God.
That was one of my favourite aspects, too.
I have to say.
I don't know.
Get to the chopper!
I'm still struggling to put towards something beyond that I really enjoyed on how to articulate why. You come back to me in a year.
It was good and that.
Because I'm struggling just now, tell me why you didn't like it, perhaps, and then...
Okay, right off the bat, let me say I think this is Christopher Nolan's weakest film, right? It's certainly the weakest in the trilogy of Batman films, but bear in mind that criticism that I'm going to level at this film over the next minute or so should be taken in the context of that Christopher Nolan on a bad day is still better than most other people on a good day.
So it's relative.
So, in many ways, he's a victim of setting the bar so high himself, but my first and biggest problem with the film, 2 hours, 40 minutes. Really? No excuse for that, okay? You could lose, that film needs to lose 40 minutes. And the reason it needs to lose 40 minutes is because Christopher Nolan hasn't really bothered fleshing out his characters all that well, considering he's got 2 hours, 40 minutes to do it in. So you could literally chop 40 minutes out of that film and not sacrifice any of the character development or lack thereof. Bane... didn't think he was a brilliant bad guy. I've sat and thought about this for the last couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not last couple of days, because I only saw it yesterday morning, but it's close enough to 48 hours to do. I've thought about this, and it's like, okay, Bane, he's not your classic sort of Batman villain, in that he is, dare I say, slightly boring and bereft of much characteristic, other than he's apparently, we're told, psychotic. He weighs about £8 billion. His tactic is just to smash everything and anyone who gets in his way. Can't have a conversation with a group of more than two people without killing someone at random at the end of that conversation. And what's his affectation? Oh, he's in chronic constant pain, so he has this mask which infuses painkillers into his lungs or whatever. Right, okay, that's brilliant. The more I thought about it, the more I thought, actually, that's a pretty sensible choice for Nolan to have made, because of all the sort of Batman villains, he's made a decision, rightly so, to base these Batman films in a much more grounded, sort of realistic as the Batman setup can be, in a sort of contemporary, vaguely realistic setting where absolute stretch, you can imagine most of the things being feasible.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really appreciate about these is, it's not somebody getting bitten by a spider and becoming all magic.
Yeah, exactly. And in that sense, Bane actually isn't the worst villain, because in a sense, if you take his comic book physique aside, you know, in the comic book, he's this hulking sort of 8 foot tall sort of lurching crone. The nearest you can get to that is Tom Hardy having put on 30 odd pounds or whatever And that's good enough. And that makes sense in the context of these films, actually.
Sensibly ditched the idea of like this kind of Captain America like super serum that I think is what makes him strong in the comics.
And also the stupid sort of luchador inspired full face mask, which would just have been insane.
You're right. That's one of the things I've enjoyed about the Nolan films in particular. He's tried to keep it as grounded in, it's maybe future technology 4, but most of it's based on technology and discipline and physicality rather than magic.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't
it? If this had been, I don't know, Tim Burton doing it again, it could have been the mutated giant walking crocodile that was referenced in a wee sideline by Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Killer Croc gets a sort of almost nod, doesn't he, in the dialogue?
Yeah.
Now, Killer Croc would have been a stupid bloody villain to have
in one
of these films, yeah.
It would have fitted right inside Long Arnold Schwarzenegger, though.
Yeah. You're not sending me to the cooler. So that stuff aside, the pacing of the film I thought was pretty tragic. My backside was numb for pretty much the first hour and a half of that film.
See, that's the thing, because... sorry, Craig.
No.
You're saying that about the 40 minutes being chopped out. And I agree with you to an extent that the characters could be more fleshed out, but
In the space that he's got, goddamn, he should be hung up and shot for... for not having done a better job of that.
Apart from the call of my bladder at one point, I didn't really feel the running time.
Yeah, it didn't. Granted, it didn't feel like 2 hours 40. It didn't feel like Avatar. I was watching like the third part of the Lord of the Rings trilogy or anything like that.
And my buttocks felt every minute of Avatar.
It was still far too long, and that length could have been excused if he had delivered the emotion that he promised in this. This was going to be the big, if the other films were about X, Y, and Z, this film was apparently going to be the emotional climax to all. And to be honest with you, aside from a couple of scenes with Jack Carter, aside from a couple of scenes with Michael Caine, who's criminally underused in this film, which had me sort of like choking back a... You know, oh dear me, I think I've got something in my eye. Where is this emotion you promised? Because it's nowhere I can see. There was less spectacle than I'd hoped for. Again, it would probably feel like there were a lot more spectacle if you chopped 40 minutes of nothing happening out of the film. I just felt like he's dropped the ball at the last minute. I just feel like the edit, I feel like I could go into an Avid suite with that footage and I could come up with a better edit of that film. And that I shouldn't ever feel like that. But I genuinely think I could have edited together a better version of that film that would have been shorter, more succinct, and would have allowed me to go home half an hour earlier. But again, contextualise that in the sense that it is still, for me, it's still, I had this conversation just before we started recording with my man in Japan, Jonathan Hillhouse. He said he would give this film an 8. I said I would give it a 7. I could be pushed to an 8 if it were reasonably argued. It's not that I didn't like the film. It's just that in the context of the previous films, I thought it was a disappointment. But again, Christopher Nolan, even if this is, I genuinely think, his weakest film, it's still better than most other stuff I've seen this year. And it's still an intelligent summer blockbuster film, which again, it gets a pass for that alone. That's me done.
I thought it was the best film I've seen this year. I am fairly sure it will be the best film I see this year. I thought there was a hell of a lot of spectacle in here. Again, it's the usual thing of Nolan managing to use CG where it's appropriate and physical effects where it is. And he's managed to blend this so well that I'm now at the point where I'm never exactly sure what he's going to do that is CG and what isn't CG.
That
bit at the start where he's basically ripping a jet apart by attaching it to another plane. I was still watching that going, well, it's actually not out with realms of possibility that he's actually just done that. He managed to do that so much better than anyone else. And things like the big pitched battles at the end, you can have these big crowd fights. We've been seeing many sort of epic films for ages, and it just looks like CG things battering other CG things.
Yeah.
It looks so much better when you just get hundreds of extras to panel each other.
Yeah.
that creates these really effective scenes. And the fight choreography in it, I thought, was brilliant. It's unlike anything you've seen in most of the other films. It has far more brutality. I really liked Bane as a character. I didn't think I would, especially when you first kind of meet him and the... always sounds like he's just about to announce what train's pulled up on platform 5.
Yeah.
But the more you kind of get used to him and his voice, it's such an interesting juxtaposition between his voice and his erudition and the hulking brute that he actually is.
Yeah, do you know what that's kind of like? This will be a reference that most of our listeners won't get, I think, but it's the same juxtaposition of SRAM from Terrorhawks. You know, this terrifying alien monster who opens his mouth and has this cut glass English accent.
That's a pretty good correlation, actually.
Right, I'll agree. I don't think it's to the level of the previous two films, but I'd be hard-pushed to find many films that are at the level of the previous two films.
Oh, aye.
I agree. I think it could be shorter. Particularly, there's at least one sort of somewhat aborted act with, who says it, Matthew Modine's the kind of police lieutenant. He's cowardly for a while, then he comes back at the end. That's pointless.
That was a weaker thread, certainly.
There's other bits where I think it could be shorter, but I'm not sure what I'd cut out apart from that. It's playing faster and looser with suspension of disbelief than all the rest of them somehow, especially Batman's rehab plans, which if we were could save the NHS millions if that's all you really need to fix a broken back. Like I say, the entire plan that Bane has for Gotham seems needlessly esoteric.
Yeah, it certainly does.
It kind of took me a little while to realise that it is. What's happening there is almost irrelevant. Again, it's one of these things where the real battle's happening somewhere else and it's happening in a prison elsewhere. I'm not sure about the emotion of things. What I did feel this did is it was a tremendous way to end the character arc. It's about Batman and his struggles with everything and him actually finding an ending to all this, and I thought that was really well played out. I thought that was, as a film, it's kind of like the Dude's Rug. It just really ties the trilogy together. All these little bits, like having just watched the other two films over the last like week or so, you get all these lovely little moments, like throwaway lines about costume redesign getting paid off at the end of this film and other bits. It just shows what a bit of planning can do if you actually set an arc and plan it out and have some kind of idea of what you're doing before you get into it. Unlike, say, what's going to happen with the Hobbit now trilogy and these other things.
Don't get me started.
I thought this film has been done so well that I can't imagine any other Batman film being anything other than a grave disappointment, which doesn't bode well for the Justice League film that's coming up in a couple of years.
Mm.
Of all of the Batman films that we've seen so far from Nolan, yeah, it's the most flawed, but I still think it's the best film I've seen this year. I can't really give it much more of a recommendation than that.
I think that I'm more or less right alongside what Scott said there, Craig. You were asking earlier, I was struggling to articulate it. Fortunately, Scott's rather done it for me. Yes, it's probably the weakest of Nolan's three, but again, that's damn it with faint praise, isn't it?
Do you not think it's just his weakest film full stop?
No.
Fair comment.
I think Insomnia is far weaker.
Yeah?
Yeah, far weaker Insomnia.
I personally prefer it, but no, I can see where you would be coming from with that.
And Insomnia also is a remake, and I think the original's better, but no, and you hit it right in the nail right in the head early on though, Craig. He set himself such a high bar. There was always a danger of it being a disappointment because the other two are just so good.
Yeah, it's only a disappointment in the context of the trilogy.
Yeah, exactly. It's a suitably dark ending. It's really interesting. Technically, it's spectacular.
Mm.
It just makes every other superhero film you've ever seen look like a silly cartoon.
Mm. It's that thing as well. If I want to mention like really specific stuff, but I don't know there's one thing in particular that really pissed me off about it. But you know, I don't. Are we doing spoilers and are we going to do a spoiler warning? Can we discuss the end of the film?
I wonder if you're going to talk about that, because I had something to say about that too. Because that's the one point. Are we talking about Mr. Carter and his payoff at the end? At the very last scene, when you've got Alfred's in Florence, in a throwback to a scene he mentions in an earlier scene, it's probably the only one thing I would change, and I just think it's not necessary. And Scott actually put it particularly well when we came out of the cinema. He said it rather cut the legs out from underneath the very emotional scene at the gravestones just before it.
Yeah.
Which, what? I think is why it shouldn't have been there.
Yeah.
But the reason that I can see why people might think it's worth keeping, and it's why I can't quite decide whether I want it there or not,
mm-hmm.
is not because it's like a get out for Bruce Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that. I think that scene is in there not for fans of the Bruce Wayne character. I think that's there for fans of Alfred, the character. Yeah. Alfred, and for his faith in Bruce and his love for him to be repaid and for him not to see like he's failed.
Exactly, and it was the only right way to end the film, really, because Alfred had been paid such short thrift throughout the rest of it, when he was one of the few, if any, characters that I felt any sort of emotional resonance with. I would keep that scene there, but here's how it would play out for me. Alfred sits down at the table, he's sitting there. He looks up at the camera, he looks into the camera, he smiles, and he nods his head at the camera. Then he gets up out of his seat and walks away, and that's the end of the film. I don't want it to cut to Bruce Wayne sitting at the table opposite, acknowledging him. I don't want to see that.
You want the spinning top.
Exactly. Yes. I was going to say, Scott, exactly, yes, you want it to be.
Exactly.
Like, you don't want to know whether you think, right, I'm thinking he's looking across the table at Bruce Wayne, because as soon as that scene starts, you know
precisely
where it's going.
What I want to come away from the cinema thinking is Alfred nodding in recognition of, because the genius of it was to have him look straight into the camera, is he not nodding in acknowledgement of Bruce Wayne, Or is he nodding in acknowledgement of you as the audience?
Oh, no, I don't think you'd ever think that, because I'd be breaking the fourth wall and it wouldn't fit with any of the rest of the film.
It would be breaking the fourth wall, but at least it would prompt some discussion. I don't need to see Bruce Wayne sitting across the table. That's the crucial part. I didn't want to see...
I don't think you need to suggest that maybe he's the thing, but I think, yeah, you don't need to see that person. I think you assume he's there, but maybe you're just not certain.
Yeah.
And that's what you have, a sort of Inception-like ending, but maybe...
Exactly.
Perhaps that's why. Perhaps because Inception did end like that, that's why he doesn't want it.
Hmm.
I can see why you want that. I think it makes it more interesting as a film. But I think in terms of, again, just going back to his character arc, I think you need to cut back to Bruce Wayne there. You need to kind of show that he's now, if not whole, more or less better. He's not the kind of ravaged individual that you see at the start of the film. He's not this, you know, banged up, hopeless cripple anymore. He now has a life.
But you don't need to see that, because earlier on, because Alfred explains that that's what he imagines, is that he would look across and see him happily sat there with a wife and perhaps some kids, and that then he would be happy and he would nod and he would acknowledge him, but he wouldn't say anything, and then he would get up and leave. And that's what he did. So that's why I don't think you need to see Bruce Wayne, because the precondition of that being the case has been set earlier in the film.
So if you know that that's what is going to be, then why does it make any difference that you've seen what you've now assumed that he's going
to
see?
Yeah, but it's just nice to leave something to the imagination.
But that's one point where I really don't think it would make it any better. It would just give you something else to kind of talk about around the pub. I don't think it would make it a better film or a worse film to do either of these. I think what it's trying to do here is show that it's now completed this character arc now. You've got Bruce Wayne happy, and that's it. You don't have that talking point anymore because you've seen it. That's the whole point of this film.
I get that. You're saying it would be a pretty cheap way just to shoehorn in an extra talking point.
Yeah, because the whole film is about deconstructing Batman, then rebuilding him. And if you don't have the terminus at the end,
you don't have the payoff of seeing him rebuilt.
Yeah, it's actually, it does pay off too. A line from the end of Batman Begins, when there's Rachel and Bruce are standing in the ashes of Wayne Manor, and she says to him that, yes, I said I would be there for the day when Gotham didn't need Batman, but I can't ever foresee the day happening when you don't need Batman.
Yeah.
But it's happened.
No, you've argued that quite convincingly, Scott, I have to say. I would have to go away and think about that now, because I hadn't considered it that way.
It definitely would make it a more interesting film if you just cut it there, and I've heard the argument from other people as well, and I agree that it would make it a more interesting film, but I don't think it makes it interesting in a good way. I think it's better to have it being emotionally complete rather than just have a talking point at the end.
Yeah. The talking point is a good fit for Inception, but maybe it's not what this film needs.
I thought it provided a really good way to bookend. That scene made this trilogy complete. It was the closing of this arc, and it really shut down any kind of...
It'll be interesting to see if he discusses that then in a commentary on the commercial release. I would like to hear, because I can imagine he would probably argue it exactly the way you just have, in which case it's a good enough explanation for me. But no, it's not that I wouldn't want people to think that I didn't like the film. Like I say, it's still better than most things I've seen, so I just felt it was... I felt it wasn't as good as it could have been. More than anything, I really wanted it to be as good as the others, just so that we could say, do you know what, this is like the best trilogy, or up there with the greatest trilogies, certainly in recent history, but I really don't think it... I don't think this trilogy qualifies as that anymore on the strength of this third one. But that's just me being a nitpicker.
I mean, I think it does. Mm. I mean, it's...
I'd agree with that.
I've heard it said that this is sort of the younger generations. This is to them as Star Wars was to us.
But considerably better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think this is...
No teddy bears with sticks.
No. And no danger of Nolan going back to fuck it up with retrofitting later on, one would imagine.
I would struggle to think of a better trilogy.
I'll give it another watch. I'm not going to go back to the cinema, I don't think. I don't want to watch anything that long that doesn't engage me the way it did from anything other than the comfort of my own sofa. But when it is on demand, I will watch it again and I will reassess it. It's one of those where I came out of the cinema because I went to see it with my wife, and she thought, she was like, oh God, yeah, I really enjoyed that. And I'm like, I came out thinking, is it one of those where I've just gone to see this on the wrong day? Am I in a particularly cynical mood today? Or, you know, because I really did want to go in and be blown away, and I wasn't. But I shall reevaluate at a later date, and we can discuss.
I have some sympathy for that. I mean, it didn't have quite the same impact coming out of it as, say, like the Dark Knight did. But it's one of these films where the more I think about this and how it fits in with other films, the more I like it. It fits well into the trilogy.
I think what I need to do is go and watch the first two again.
That's what I asked you. Did you watch that beforehand? Because I did the week before, and you said you did too, Scott, didn't you?
Yeah, I suspect it would be... Right, I
think that would help.
I didn't sort of wail on it for this, because I think if you're going to watch the last film in a trilogy, then it kind of there's a level of assumption that you've seen the first two. But I think this one does benefit more than anything else of having seen the first two quite recently.
Yeah.
Because there's threads all the way throughout it that ties up from just like throwaway comments, as I say, from like previous films.
Yeah.
And that does kind of just anchor it far better.
Yeah, stuff you might not necessarily have to mind if, like me, you know, the last time you watched Dark Knight was like, not even this time last year, sort of 18 months ago or something like that.
Yeah. I think it... more than anything else, it benefits from, you know, proximity to the other two.
Mm. Because it does have such a strong arc, as well as references and things, but the arc's so strong that it is of a piece. It's not just sort of stuff latched on into the same universe.
The thing is that, as well, like, whenever I think about going back to review watch The Dark Knight again, I just think, oh God, I've got to go through that ending again, because it was just, it had too many endings for me. I think that was let down by the last real kind of thing. But yeah, I shall have to then. When it comes time to catch up with The Dark Knight Rises again, I shall watch Batman Begins and The Dark Knight beforehand. I'll do a little, I'll have a lock-in day. I'll watch all three in one day. That's it, isn't it? We haven't got anything else to talk about?
That's your lot.
Stick that in your pipe and smoke it.
If you want to add your own thoughts to ours, though, you can contact us at podcast@theoneliner.com.
Indeed you can.
Tell us why we're right or wrong. Obviously we're right, but if you want to argue otherwise, feel free.
If you want us to come around and give you a slap, good grief. Or follow us on Twitter @TheOneLiner. Couldn't be easier. Fair enough. What will we be talking about next time, guys?
Brave. Is that out? Ted? I forget.
The Man Inside. Ted. The Flowers of War. Searching for Sugarman.
Possibly. Depending on
possibly these and others. We'll also be talking about LOLJK, You Are a Goat Sexor, which I've just realised is still on there.
One of Stephen Nolan's best films.
One of Stephen Nolan's sophomore effort, which obviously has a lot of expectation riding on it. Okay, guys, thanks for listening again. We will be back fairly soon with our next podcast. Until then, fare thee well. I was Craig. Scott was Scott.
Did I ask you?
Oops, you just give me the hiccups, man. And Drew was Drew.
Bye.
Take it easy, guys. Bye. It seems the end of the podcast, at which point I was planning to secretly turn into a giant wasp, has been spoiled.
Oh, I'm disappointed you weren't planning to turn into bees, millions of bees.
All around us now, trying to get in. Is it... Is it any better now?